We'll open to Proverbs, and I need to apologize on the front end. I think it's going to be kind of helter-skelter tonight. My prep time today kind of got cut short, so I'm not real organized. I have a lot of things for us to talk about, but I think what we'll have to do is just sort of take several different lines and kind of hope it all holds together and is coherent at the end of the night. But to get us started, let's do this. Let's just read several passages out of Proverbs. Let's read Proverbs 10, verses 5 and 6. I tell you what, I'm just going to assign these because we go around. So, Jessica, you want to take Proverbs 10, 5, and 6. And then, let's see, I've got my list here. Deborah, you want to take 10, 26. And then... Sarah, do you have a mom? Oh, perfect. That'll work. Proverbs 18:9. And then, Joseph, you want to take, let's see, 24, well, we read this one last week, but we'll read it again. 24:30 to 34. I think we read that last week. And then I skipped over one. So let's do, Jimmy, why don't you do 14:23. If we do any more, I'll pick up with you, Ryan, and go ahead and just start reading those verses.
Okay, Proverbs 10, 5 and 6. He who gathers in summer is a wise son. He who sleeps in harvest is a son who causes shame. Blessings are on the head of the righteous, but violence covers the mouth of the wicked.
That's right. Yeah, go ahead. We'll just read all of them.
As vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is a sluggard to those who send him.
Okay, and then what was the next one?
18:9.
Did I skip you, Katie?
It's taking a while.
Guess y'all sharing a Bible. Threw me off. Okay. Do I need to give you my Wi-Fi password?
No.
Never mind, I just lost my
Whoever is slack in his work is a brother to him who destroys.
I passed by the field of the sluggard, by the vineyard of the man lacking sense, and behold, it was all overrun with thorns. The ground was covered with needles, and its stone wall was broken down. Then I saw and considered it. I looked and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber, and want like an armed man.
Then, 14:23. In all toil there is profit, but mere talk tends only to poverty.
Okay, great. There's a lot in the book of Proverbs about diligence and laziness. You know, you've got the wise man who works hard, who labors, and then you've got the sluggard. Jimmy, I think you actually gave me this Proverbs classified by topic little booklet. And so there's about, you know, it's like over three pages, that's three pages, I guess, or maybe that's like two pages, I guess, on verses that just have to do with laziness versus hard work. So there's a lot in Proverbs about this. And what I want us to do tonight is, again, sort of step back and get the big picture, and then we'll look at some of these particular verses and what they have to teach us about work. Christians have historically referred to our work as a calling or a vocation. That's how Christians will talk about what they do. Now, if you talk about work as a calling, that means there must be a
caller.
Yes, one who calls. And so that means that you reimagine your work, you envision your work as being done for another. It's another who has assigned you this work. It's another that you are accountable to for this work. So really, you know, Christians say it's God who calls us to the whatever work we're given to do. If you're a student, that's your work. If you're a homemaker, that's your work. If you're out there and, you know, if you're like Jonathan Miller tonight working at Chick-fil-A, you know, that's your calling, whatever it may be. If you're like Ryan out there selling insurance, you know, that's your calling, okay? So God assigns us our post. He assigns us our place to work and to serve. And that's really, really important. That means that we have to think of our work as a mission of service that God himself has given to us. We do the work ultimately for God. We're ultimately accountable to God for how we do it. We don't just work for our own sake, for our own self-interest, or for our own fulfillment. There's something that goes beyond that. Work is a form of service to the one who has called us to this work. And we talked last time about how work really has its beginnings in the creation. Remember, we saw last week Genesis 1, in the beginning was the worker. God himself, the creator, goes to work. And he's got this six-day work week in which he makes the whole world and everything in it. And so because of that, there's really two things we can say about work when God creates man and then gives to him work. Work has dignity, and work is what we're designed for. So the dignity of work, the design of work. Really, really important to understand that work predates the fall, man's fall into sin. And that's a different view of work than what you would get in other, I would say, ancient and modern worldviews or cultures. So for example, you know, the Greek, in Greek mythology, sort of the Greek fall, if you will, of the creation takes place when Pandora's box is opened up and all these evils come out, okay? And one of the evils that comes out basically is work. You know, among all the other kinds of suffering and misery that are imposed upon the human race, that includes work. Work is just seen as a curse. It's seen as something that results from evil. Work itself is a kind of evil. And that's why the Greeks always looked down on manual labor. It's why they wanted slaves to do the manual labor for them. Christians, and of course you go back to, you know, ancient Jews, have never looked at it that way. There's always been this dignity that's given to all work because God himself is a worker. In fact, we can say God himself is a manual worker, a manual labor, working with his hands, even getting his hands in the dirt in Genesis 2 to form man, to fashion man out of the clay of the earth. So work is there in paradise in the beginning. Work precedes the fall. And that means the right kind of work is essential to human flourishing. Work does not exhaust the meaning of life. There's more to life than work. But work is a huge part of the meaning of life, and you cannot have a fulfilled life or a flourishing life without work. It's just built into our DNA. God has this work week in Genesis 1, and that sets the pattern for man. And there's work in paradise. Jesus, in fact, in John chapter 5, says, "My Father's been working from the beginning, and I am working." That's how God defines himself, in part, is as a worker. And if we're made in his image, then we've got to be workers as well. So you've got the dignity of work, the goodness of work, okay? That there is going to be a kind of satisfaction and joy that comes from work. And without work, life is going to be, it's going to be fruitless, we're going to be ineffective, we're not going to be happy and fulfilled and satisfied the way that we should. Part of this is just the whole, you know, the whole biblical worldview is very pro-physical. You know, God made matter, God made the world, and creation's good. And that's reflected in our work that takes place in the creation. But the other thing we have to understand in the very early chapters of Genesis is the design of human work. God says to man in Genesis 1, that he is to be fruitful and multiply, and he's also to subdue the earth and to have dominion over it. So God says you're to fill the earth, you're to do family, and you're to subdue the earth. You're to do work. And work there's got to be understood as a form of stewardship. God's the owner of everything, and now God is handing over the title deed, as it were, to the creation, to man, and saying, here, this is yours, now get to work. I have started this project of developing my creation over these 6 days. I want you to pick it up from here and move the world from one degree of glory to a greater degree of glory. Structuring and shaping the creation, taking the untapped potential that is there and bringing creation to its fullest realization, turning the Garden of Eden into the city of God, the New Jerusalem. And that's why the Bible begins in a garden and it ends in a city. You know, what is the city? But simply human beings taking the raw material of the creation and transforming it into something productive and useful for the whole human community. And that's what God wants us to do. He wants us to build a culture, to build a civilization that will honor him. We're not building Babel, we're building the New Jerusalem. What's interesting is in Genesis 2, when God gets more specific about the work and puts man in the garden, he says the man is to tend and keep the garden. Now, what's interesting is those same verbs in the Hebrew show up later to describe the work that the priest would do at the tabernacle and then later in Israel's history at the temple. Which, if you read that back into Genesis, what does that tell you about Adam's work in the garden?
Priestly work.
It's priestly work. Yeah, work from the beginning was to be priestly sacrifice offered to God. I don't know, was it Benedict? Who was it that said work is prayer? Okay, and for the Christian, there's really a sense in which that ought to always be the case, that our work is a form of worship. Our work is a form of prayer. There's no sharp line between, all right, now we're worshiping and now we're working. There's worship in the narrow sense when we gather as God's people and we sing his praises and give him thanks and have the Lord's Supper together and all of that. But then there's worship in this broad sense. All of life should be worship. Our work should be a form of worship, a form of service rendered to God as we are priests. So this means to refuse to work is to violate your design. It's to violate your nature. You know, you think about your car, okay? If you never change the oil in your car, what's going to happen? Okay? It's going to die because you're violating the nature of the car. You've got to tend and care for your car. You've got to keep your car up. Okay? All right? Well, and if you don't, you've violated the nature of that car. And it's going to be destroyed. And really, that's what we do to ourselves when we refuse to work. There's something very, very destructive, not only for society, but also for ourselves when we refuse to embrace work. We break down, society breaks down. It's just not the way things should be. So God wants us to cultivate his creation, to transform the creation into a beautiful civilization, which will bring him glory. So that means doing things like taking grains of sand and turning them into computer chips. It means taking chickens and turning them into sandwiches. Okay? I mean, seriously, yeah, that's the kind of thing it means. All right? It means taking a forest of trees and turning it into a neighborhood and ships and whatever else. Okay? It means we take what's there in the creation and we transform it. You know, with the whole radical environmental movement that's out there today, it sees man as a parasite that just is a, everything man does in some way is seen as a negative, like it's a violation of nature, a raping of nature. That's not the view that Scripture gives us. Certainly we have to be stewards and caretakers so we don't just exploit the creation. We want to take good care of it. Maybe this is how we should think of ourselves. In the beginning, Adam is not told to be a park ranger. Okay, what does a park ranger do with the park? He wants to keep it exactly as he found it. He does not want to change a thing. You know, the trees, the animals, everything that's there is to stay just the way it is. Okay? Compare that to what a gardener does. What's a gardener does? A gardener takes a plot of ground and what does he do with it?
Create something with it.
Yeah, he transforms it, all right? So he plants things there, and he pulls up weeds, and he fertilizes, and he waters, and he maybe puts a fence up to keep animals out, and you know, all kinds of things. He's transforming the creation to make it fruitful, to shape it and structure it and order it in a particular way. We're not park rangers. They are just leaving the creation as it is. We're gardeners who transform the creation so that it flowers, so its full beauty is manifest. Okay, so that's our design. That's what we're called to do. Now, so that gives you kind of the big picture of work. Let's start to talk about some of these particular passages here that we've looked at. Proverbs 10. Proverbs Proverbs 10, 4 and 5. And I'll just read this again. He who has a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. He who gathers in summer is a wise son. He who sleeps in harvest is a son who causes shame. So one thing you see all throughout the book of Proverbs, you see the consequences of laziness brought out. What are the consequences of laziness here? Start with verse 4.
Poverty.
Okay, poverty. Yeah. Okay. So a slack hand, he who has a slack hand becomes poor. So it's the kind of thing that Paul says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 when he says if a man doesn't work, he shouldn't eat. Okay. If you're able-bodied, you know, if you're capable of working, you ought to work. And if you're not willing to work, then you shouldn't eat either. There should be this connection. Eventually, your hunger pains will get so bad, you'll say, okay, maybe I should, you know, do something. And so in a sense, you could say laziness carries with it its own punishment. But the point here is just to say, look, if you're not going to do the work, you're not going to ever get ahead in life. You're always going to be falling into poverty. The hand of the diligent makes rich. Obviously, you know, Proverbs could be misinterpreted to teach a kind of health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. Like if you just do the right things, then you'll get these results. Obviously, the world's more complex than that. And Proverbs actually acknowledges that in various ways. And then you read the book of Ecclesiastes and you see that actually the world's a whole lot more complicated than Proverbs makes it look. But remember, Proverbs is for the young man. Ecclesiastes is for the old man. That's kind of how it goes. It's this is what his father teaches his son when he's a child. Ecclesiastes is the reflections of an older man, the meditations of an older man now that he's seen so much more. And it's not that the two contradict one another. It's that together they show us both the patterns of God's providential ordering of his creation, but also the complexities and mysteries in that. Proverbs shows you the patterns. Ecclesiastes shows you the mysteries. Okay? But then look at verse 5. He who gathers in summer is a wise son. So this is the person who's got foresight, who's thinking ahead, planning ahead, saving for the future, storing up what he'll need in the future. That's wisdom. To be wise is to have a future orientation. There's a huge problem in our culture of people just living for the moment, living for the present. Okay, that's foolish. But then look at what it says. What does it say about the one who sleeps in harvest?
It causes shame.
Yeah, he brings shame. Now, why is the word shame used there? Why doesn't it say, for example, that that son who sleeps through harvest brings guilt on himself? Why shame? I talked about this in a sermon actually a few weeks ago. We'll see who was listening.
Shame is different. Shame is guilt is like a courtroom verdict. I remember you saying that.
Yeah, that's good. All right. Yeah.
That's good. Shame is like I guess almost like a utter embarrassment of yourself. Okay. I guess.
Yeah, guilt is in reference to some legal standard. And you're guilty when you haven't met that standard, when you've fallen short of the standard or violated the standard in some way. So sin brings guilt. And it could say guilt here, because obviously one who's lazy in this way has violated a standard. Okay? But shame is different, and the word shame is used here, I think it's very significant. Shame has to do with your standing or your position in the community. Okay? It's not how the courtroom views you, it's how the community views you. Why would the son who sleeps in harvest cause shame? And what does that tell us about work?
I mean, people value work. You look at the lazy person and you kind of view them with distaste because they're not doing anything for themselves or for the community and not building or helping in any way.
What are we to think of a person who, for no good reason, just because he's lazy, consumes more than he produces, or takes more than he gives with reference to the community? That's why this is shameful. This son, I think it's even significant he's called a son. It doesn't just say the person who sleeps through harvest brings shame. It's the son. He's set in the context of his familial or communal relationships. And he's letting down his family, he's letting down his community by his laziness. Okay, this I think it's really, really significant when we start to think this out. We talked about our work as a calling. That means there's more to work than just our own self-interest, more to work than just getting what you need for yourself so you can survive or so you can buy what you want, more to work than just your own whatever fulfillment and satisfaction you're going to get out of it. Work is given to us to serve the common good. Now, do you understand what I mean by the common good? I mean the good of the human community, the wider society around us. Okay, now think about this. How this works. And here's where, if I had more time, I could have put this together in a more organized way, but we'll just kind of do this on the fly. When we pray in the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread, what are we praying for? What are we asking God to do? Give us this day our daily bread. Are we asking God to drop manna out of the sky like he did for the Israelites in the wilderness? So what are we praying for?
We're praying for the weed to grow.
Okay.
And someone to grind the weed and make flour. And the baker and make bread. And
truck driver, the get whole, it there. Yeah. The people who run the internet so the orders can be placed and get to where they need to go. The guy who runs the grocery store and stocks
sure
the shelves.
About the internet back then.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, no, they weren't. But the point is, the
Jesus
point
works.
Is,
Jesus
yeah,
works.
Jesus was. Yeah. The point is, there is this, you know, we call it the World Wide Web because we see it as a way that we're all connected. But the reality is we were all connected to one another long before we had the World Wide Web. Okay? Let me ask you this. I've actually got one of these in my pencil, so in my pockets, we use this as an example of pencil. This is just, you know, your ordinary number two pencil. Now let me ask you a question. If you needed to, could you make one of these?
No.
I mean, it's just cost a few cents at the store. Could you make one of these if you had to? Okay, why?
Millions of people
don't know
in.
How.
Has anybody ever read the essay, I, Pencil?
I've heard part of it.
Okay, you can go home and Google it tonight, and they've actually got now, they've condensed it to like a, you know, speaking of the web, like a 5-minute YouTube video presentation, which is really, really good. There's actually nobody in the world who knows how to make a pencil. You know that? There's not a single person in the world who can make a pencil from scratch.
I believe that.
If you were going to make a pencil, where would you start? What's the first thing you would need?
You need the capital to go cut down the trees.
Okay, so let's just say you got it. It's just you. You're on your own. You've got to cut down a tree. How are you going to cut down a tree?
Axe.
Okay, well, where are you going to get the axe?
Harvester.
No, there's no harvester. It's just you. You can go stand against the tree and push and hope it falls over.
I'd probably just go find like a branch.
Hey, think about it, okay? The loggers, okay, what if you're an if you're a what do you call it? A
lumberjack.
Yes, okay. Let's say you use a chainsaw. Think of what goes into the chainsaw that the lumberjack uses. Okay, it takes millions of people, obviously, to produce a chainsaw. Okay, from the designers and the people who make the plastic and the metal parts and assemble it and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so but I'll spot you the chainsaw. Okay, so let's go for it. You have got a chainsaw. I'm giving you that as a freebie. So now you can cut down your tree. So you cut down your tree. Now what? Okay. I mean, if you had to make a chainsaw on your own, it'd probably cost you, you know, $1 billion, and it'd take you 2 or 3 lifetimes to do it. Okay, but I'm giving you the chainsaw, so now what? You can cut down the tree.
It'd be hard to cut out a pencil shape,
though. That's true. A chainsaw would not do that very well. A chainsaw, you could not get a piece of wood this shape out of a chainsaw.
Knife just to cut down the little branch and then
okay.
Whittle out a little.
Okay.
You gotta get the lead.
I
don't even know where.
Well, most pencils say have graphite in them. Okay, graphite, most of the graphite, from what I understand, is mined in China.
Oh.
So how are you going to get your graphite for the pencil?
Go to China.
Go to China.
But how are you going to get there?
Long walk.
Walk.
Walk
to China.
Jesus could.
You'd have to build a boat, right?
I'm built building an airport.
So think that all of it goes into building a boat. Okay.
Well, that takes us back to step one with the chainsaw. Yes.
But, you know, because it would take you $1 billion to build a boat on your own and several lifetimes, I'll spot you the boat. All right.
Can I get, like, a jet?
Or you could fly over there, yes, but that'd be several billion dollars in several lifetimes as well. Especially since you'd probably have a lot of trial and error learning how to fly and probably wouldn't survive all those.
Yeah.
So, but I'll spot you a boat to get you to China so that you can go to where there is graphite in the ground. But how are you going to get the graphite out of the ground?
Chisel it away.
Oh, it's a rock.
Okay.
I don't even know how it exists, like, naturally. Like, I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't either.
Oh.
we're just making this up as we go. Yeah, so we'd have a slight problem getting the graphite out of the ground. There's no telling what kind of equipment would be needed to extract the graphite, how deep you'd have to dig into the earth, what it would take to get that graphite into usable form. I mean, who knows what all is involved in that. But now you've got your wood from the tree. You've got your graphite. Let's talk about the elixir.
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah.
Well, then let's talk about the metal that goes around it.
Okay.
Do you see how complicated this is getting?
It makes you appreciate the pencil more.
Yes, exactly. And that's why I say, there's nobody in the world who knows everything you'd have to know to make a pencil. Everything there is to know to get graphite out of the earth, to get the wood in the right shape, to make the rubber, to make the metal, to assemble the whole thing. I mean, it is an incredible process that requires thousands, if not millions, of people. And if you're going to do it on your own, I mean, you couldn't make a pencil in one lifetime if it was just up to you. And yet you can buy this thing at the store for just a few pennies. Okay? What does that tell you about the way God works in the world?
We have to work together.
Think about what the Apostle Paul says about the church. You know, 1 Corinthians, he calls the church one body with many members and talks about how we've all been given these different gifts so that we can serve one another for the sake of the good of the whole community. Okay? What Paul is saying about the church there is basically what a healthy human civilization has on a large scale. There are all these different gifts and all these different resources that are out there. People have different interests and different abilities and different skill sets and different know-how. And in a healthy society, and this is really what makes a civilization, your work fits in with everybody else's work so that your work serves the common good. And so you can take however many people, you know, are required to make this. You can get things like a pencil. And you can get things like computers. Okay? I mean, the pencil is simple. Think about all the really complicated stuff that's out there that we have, that we just take for granted. I mean, you know, things like, you know, who can make a cell phone, you know? I mean, there's just no way, okay? So, you know, a pencil is a great illustration of how this works. Okay? What this means is God works through our work. I want to read to you how Martin Luther put this because it's so helpful. Martin Luther, I think, really understood this about as well as anybody ever has. I just got to find the quote here. Let's see. Well, maybe I don't have it, actually. Well, let me read this. This is from Lester DeCoster. This may do what we need. He says, "Work is the form in which we make ourselves useful to others and which others make themselves useful to us." So think about that. What is work? Work is how you make yourself useful to other people. At the same time, the other person's work is how he's making himself useful to you. We plant with our work. God gives the increase to unify the human race. He says, look at the chair you're lounging in. So it's the same kind of example. Could you have made it for yourself? How would you get, say, the wood? Go and fell a tree, but only after first making the tools for that and putting together some kind of vehicle to haul the wood and constructing a mill to do that, to do the lumber and roads to drive on from place to place. In short, a lifetime or two just to make one chair. If we worked not 40, but 140 hours per week, we couldn't make ourselves from scratch even a fraction of all the goods and services that we call our own. Our paycheck turns out to buy us the use of far more than we could possibly make for ourselves in the time it takes us to earn the check. Remember, I said you can buy a pencil, you know, for just a few pennies. Okay, it doesn't take any of us very long to earn a few pennies. But if you had to make a pencil from scratch, you know, again, you're talking about several lifetimes. So think about, because all of our gifts and abilities are pooled together, we get something that would take us a zillion dollars to make on our own. We get it for just a few pennies. That's how it works. He says, work yields far more in return upon our efforts than our particular jobs put in. He says, then, imagine that everyone quits working right now. What happens? Civilized life melts away. Food vanishes from the shelves. Gas dries up at the pump. Streets are no longer patrolled and fires burn themselves out. Communication and transportation services end. Utilities go dead. Those who survive at all are soon huddled around campfires, sleeping in caves, clothed in raw animal hides. The difference between a wilderness and a culture is simply work. Okay? It is our, and this is why failure to work brings shame. Okay? Because it destroys civilization. It destroys culture. When you do your work, however insignificant it might seem, okay, and this is true even if you're a student and you know and you're training for some vocation you're going to do in the future, or if you're already in that vocation, whatever your work is, it contributes to the common good, provided it's a lawful endeavor. Obviously, there are forms of work in a fallen world that don't contribute to the common good. But any kind of lawful work, okay, it's going to contribute to the common good. And it is a way that you serve the good of humanity as a whole. And it's a way, really, then, of serving God and loving your neighbor. Sometimes we don't think of work that way. We don't think that work can be a form of loving neighbor because, well, I mean, say if you've got a job, you're getting paid for it. You know, we think, well, you know, if I want to do something out of love, I would do it for free, and I'm doing it for a paycheck, then it's not done out of love. But there's actually no reason to think that way. You can get paid for doing things when you're also doing them out of love towards your neighbor. If you understand your work in this way as a calling, as a vocation. And of course, you look back at it historically, the people who have transformed wilderness into culture, into civilization, have understood just this point about work. The reason I think Luther's so significant is because Luther does a really good job talking about this in relation to our vocation. What Luther says is God works through our various forms of work. So when we pray to God, give us our daily bread, how does God answer that prayer? Well, God works through the farmer who plants the seed and harvests it. He works through the baker who turns that wheat into bread. He works through the person who drives the truck to deliver the bread to the grocery store. He works through the grocery store owner who buys the bread, the person who works in the grocery store to put the bread on the shelves, the person who works at the clerk, you know, to do the checkout counter. God also works through the person who paved the roads so that the truck could deliver the bread, or the planes that are flown to deliver the bread, whatever it might be. And you start to think about this, and you think, oh, wow, when God answers that prayer, we're really talking about God's work in all of human society, basically. How God works through everything, how God works through our work to provide us with a simple loaf of bread. And then you start to see how your own work can contribute to that whole. See, it's very easy for us to think, oh, well, my work doesn't really, I mean, what significance can it really have? But when you step back, you know, when you realize that nobody can make a pencil, you know, if you think about all of human society, you know, bound up in a pencil, and it may be that you're, you know, your whole job is just to get the graphite out of the ground, and you have no idea what to do with it then. But there couldn't be a pencil unless you did your part. And that's really how human society as a whole works. We all do our part, and somehow God works through all of our work and makes it all work together so that we get these things we need. So then when that daily bread is on our tables, you know, we ask God, God, give us this day our daily bread. Before we eat that bread, what do? We give God thanks. Yeah. We're thanking God for working through this whole system, this whole network, this whole web of relationships, this whole web of fellow workers who helped get that bread to our table. And that's why the son who sleeps through the harvest season brings shame. It's not just that his laziness is self-destructive. It is. He's destroying himself through his laziness. It's not just that hard work is a virtue and he's obviously not disciplined and diligent and so he's failing in that way. I mean, all that's true. But it brings shame because he's failing the human community. If everybody stopped working, what would happen? There wouldn't be any bread. There wouldn't be any pencils. There wouldn't be any computers. There wouldn't be any roads. There wouldn't be any cars or gas or any of the things that we need, that we use to live. It brings shame because it's a sin, not just against God, but against the community. Okay, so I think that's really, really significant. There's a lot more that could be said about that. In fact, I'm going to read a few other passages here that I think are interesting that sort of develop this point. Psalm 65, so this is not Proverbs, this is from the book of Psalms. Let me read Psalm 65, 9 and 10. Who keeps our soul among the living and does not allow our feet to be moved? For you, O God, have tested us, you have refined us as silver is refined. It's talking about here God's work. You know, who keeps our soul among the living? Who keeps us alive? God does. Let me give you another example of this. I'm going to read several passages and tell you what the point is here. Psalm 104, 30. You sent forth your spirit, and they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. This is a creation psalm that's talking about all the different aspects of God's creation. It says in verse 27, these is talking about all the wild animals. These all wait for you, that you may give them their food in due season. So it's about who feeds the animals. God does. Isaiah 28. Isaiah 28, verses 24 to 29. Does the plowman keep plowing all day to sow? Does he keep turning his soil and breaking the clods? When he has leveled its surface, does he not sow the black cumin and scatter the cumin, plant the wheat in rows, the barley in the appointed place, and the spelt in its place? For he instructs him in right judgment, for God teaches him. So who teaches the farmer his craft? It's God himself who does this. And it goes on from there. Bread, flour must be ground. Therefore, he does not thresh it forever, break it with his cartwheeler, crush it with his horseman. This also comes from the Lord of hosts, who is wonderful in counsel and excellent in guidance. And then Psalm 147, 13. For he has strengthened the bars. Well, this one's a little bit different, so let me hold off on this one. But what these passages all said, are all talking about, is God's care for the creation. Who feeds the animals? Who teaches the farmer how to grow his crops so that there can be bread? That kind of thing. And all these passages say it's God who does it. God gives to his creatures their food in its proper time. God's the one who works through this whole economy, this whole economic system, in order to provide for our needs. And we have to see our own work as a way of taking our place within that whole system, that whole economy through which God is working. God works through our work to serve others, and God works through the work of others to serve us. And that means there's always a kind of dignity, and there ought to be a kind of delight in the work that we do, even if it seems like drudgery, because we know that God is at work in it. This last one I think is interesting. This is Psalm 147, 13. It says, he has strengthened the bars of your gates. He has blessed your children within you. He makes peace in your borders and fills you with the finest wheat. Okay? And Luther took this, and again, I don't think I brought my Luther quotes with me tonight, so I'm sorry I'm not as organized, but he has strengthened the bars of your gates. Those are the gates of the city. And Luther says, well, what's it mean to have solid bars or gates, you know, at the entrance to the city? He says, this is not just about the blacksmith who actually makes the gates. This is about having sound government, having well-policed streets in the city, clean streets, good laws. He goes on and talks about all the different ordinances of the city that it would take to have those kinds of city gates, to have well-placed, well-built gates on the city. And it's true. God works through all of those things. You know, this is why the Bible is continually telling us to pray for our rulers and things like that, because this whole structure, this whole economic and political system we're a part of, it's partly how God sustains us. And it's how we're enabled to do the kind of work that he wants us to do. God wants us as human beings to flourish. He wants us to have the freedom to find the kind of vocation that we can excel in. And to do that, certain preconditions have to be in place, which we can't put in place ourselves. But providentially, if they're there, that's something that we should give great thanks for. Okay, so questions about this part of it. Maybe not the clearest explanation, but I hope that helps you understand how significant our work is. Let me see if time isn't so much. Okay, we got time. Let me go into another question. Let me ask this. I said last week, and I've already hinted at it again tonight, that the purpose of our work is not personal fulfillment. Okay? We don't just work to be fulfilled. And this is a very, I think in a lot of ways, sort of countercultural thing right now, because I think we've kind of gotten to a situation where now people think, oh, if I could just find the right job, I'll be happy at my work every day. You know, if I could just find that occupational sweet spot where I got to use all my gifts and didn't have to do anything I don't want to do, and I got paid a lot of money to do it, you know, then that's what I'm looking for. And, of course, such a job, if it exists, it's got to be very, very rare. I would imagine even, you know, say professional athletes have to do a lot of things they really don't want to do. I would guess that, you know, that there's a lot of things in any profession, even those that would seem like dream jobs, that entail doing a lot of things you don't necessarily want to do. So work is not just about fulfillment. I think it's actually easy for us in our society to kind of idolize having the right kind of job. You know, I remember reading an interview with one of the guys from Google, one of the executives, and basically talked about how, you know, I mean, we want people to come to work for us who will be world changers. You know, he talked about, you know, kind of the mission and purpose of their company. It's like, wow, you know, that would just be incredible to go to work for a company like that. But the reality is the vast majority of jobs are not going to be that way. It's just not possible. I mean, again, you go back to our pencil example, okay? If you're the guy who figures out how to make this little metal thing, you know, you may not feel like you're changing the world. But you're serving the common good because you're helping making these very useful instruments available to people for just pennies, okay? I actually don't know what a pencil costs these days, so I hope it's not a lot more expensive than I'm telling you. Does anybody know what's
pencil? Depends if there's like printed
pattern
or something.
Okay, there you go. So it can't be very expensive. Yeah. But my point is, we can't say that work is just for personal fulfillment. But then I want to ask this question: is there a sense in which we should find a measure of fulfillment in our work, and what does that look like? You know, the way I put the question last week, I said, does your employer owe you fulfillment or a paycheck? I mean, he certainly owes you a paycheck, but does he owe you fulfillment in addition to a paycheck? I don't think we can say that he does. But what then do we say about finding fulfillment in work?
It's our responsibility.
And how do we come to find a measure of joy and fulfillment and satisfaction in our work?
If we do it well, and I guess feel like we're serving God through our work.
Okay. If we're serving God, and the way to serve God in your work really is obviously to do it with excellence. So, you know, we talked about how work is priestly service. So it's a ministry that you're going to render to God. You want to have competence in that ministry, competence in that service. You know that will bring glory to God if you do it with as much excellence as you can. Also, if you're able to see how your work serves your neighbor, serves the good of your neighbor, Let me read you a couple things here. This I do have. This is from Dorothy Sayers. Let me see. This is what I want. Okay, yeah, so several things here that I think are well worth listening to. This is what Sayer says. The worker's first duty is to serve the work. So obviously, you know, we want to serve God, we want to serve neighbor in how we do our work. But Sayer's just saying, if we want to do that, we've got to serve the work itself, which means do the work well. The popular catchphrase of today is that it is everybody's duty to serve the community. It is a well-sounding phrase, but there's a catch in it. It's the old catch about the two great commandments, love God and your neighbor. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. The catch in it, which nowadays the world has largely forgotten, is that the second commandment depends upon the first, and that without the first, it is a delusion and a snare. Much of our present trouble and disillusionment have come from putting the second commandment before the first. So she says, if you want to love your neighbor through your work, you've got to first and foremost love God through your work. Do your work for God, and then it will serve the good of your neighbor. If we put neighbor first, we're putting man above God. And that is what we've been doing ever since we began to worship humanity and make man the measure of all things. Service is the motto of the advertiser, of big business, and of fraudulent finance, and of others too. Listen to this. I expect the judiciary to understand that the nation does not exist for their convenience, but that justice exists to serve the nation. That was Hitler yesterday. She was writing this in probably the 1930s. And that is what becomes of service when the community, not work, becomes the idol. There is, in fact, a paradox about working to serve the community, and it is this. That to aim directly at serving the community is to falsify the work. The only way to serve the community is to forget the community and serve the work. The only way of serving the community is to be truly in sympathy with the community, to be oneself part of the community, and then to serve the work without giving the community another thought. Then the work will endure because it will be true to itself. It is the work that serves the community. The business of the worker is to serve the work. So basically what she's saying is the way to serve others, the way to serve God in your work is to do your work well. And when you do your work well for God's sake, that's what serves the good of the community. She says, our vocation is not primarily a thing one does to live, but the thing one lives to do. It is, or it should be, the full expression of the worker's faculties, the thing in which he finds spiritual, mental, and bodily satisfaction, and the medium in which he offers himself to God. It is the business of the church to recognize that the secular vocation as such is sacred. So I think what she's saying here is that if we come to see our work as sacred, and if we recognize that our work is a medium through which we can offer ourselves to God, a way in which we can offer ourselves to God in priestly service, offering him priestly sacrifice, then we will find a kind of satisfaction in our work, even if it's very difficult for us to do, even if there are a lot of things about our particular job that we don't enjoy. We can still find joy in the work because we know that it's a form of worship. In fact, Sayers goes on, I won't read all this, but she talks about how during World War II, you know, you had all of these people from all different classes of society, some really high-class people, some lower-class people, you know, some white-collar, blue-collar, coming together. And for a lot of these people, while they were in the Army, it was the lowest pay they ever made during their professional careers for a lot of these men. And most of it was work that they really did not know all that much about when they got into it. None of them had chosen, you know, most of these men had not chosen to be professional soldiers. They'd ended up in the Army because they had to go fight Hitler, fight a war. And Sayers says that talking to a lot of these men who had fought in the World War, she says they look back on that time of their lives as the time they had the most joy and the most satisfaction of anything else they ever did. And she recounts, if I remember this right, she recounts one conversation that she had with a man, and basically, you know, after the war, he went back to practicing law, which he basically did for the sake of the money. Not because he wanted to fight for justice in the courts, but just for money. And looking back on it, he says, you know, I was really a lot happier when I was making next to nothing in the Army because we knew we were serving the good of our country. We knew we were serving the good of others. And I think what Sayers is really getting at is that if we want our work to do that, we've got to do our work well. But when we do our work well, we can find satisfaction in it, no matter what it is, because we know it is serving the good of others. And I think that's a helpful way to think of work. One last thing I want to point out, and that is, you know, if we really want to see our work as a way in which we serve God, and a way in which we serve our neighbor because we're serving God, we have to let the gospel shape the way we do our work. And so I want to close with this, with one last story here. Let me see if I can find this. Okay, yeah, here it is. So let me just read you this story. This is the story that Tim Keller gives. He's a preacher, pastor in Manhattan, New York City. And he says, this is the kind of thing that can happen when Christians do their work Christianly, when they do their work with integrity and compassion. He says, not long after we began our new church in New York City, I saw a young woman who was obviously visiting and darting out after each service. One week I intercepted her. She told me she was exploring Christianity. She didn't believe in it at that point, but she found a lot of it interesting. I asked her how she had found Redeemer, and she told me this story. She worked for a company in Manhattan, and not long after starting there, she made a big mistake that she thought would cost her her job. So she did something wrong. She messed up. She thought she was going to get fired. But her boss went into his superior and took complete responsibility for what she had done. As a result,